G'day, beloved G's and P's. I don't know about you, but whenever I hear the name Cheney, the blood freezes and I feel it's time to duck and cover. I'm talking, of course, about Dick Cheney, one of the most reprehensible people in modern history, right up at the top of the Bush administration. But these days we've got to recalibrate because of daughter Liz. Well, she's no secular saint. She's passionately and bravely anti-Trump, and that's got her into a spot of bother, as Bruce Shapiro will be explaining in just a moment. It's election day for Liz Cheney, Bruce.
It is election day, primary day. It is reckoning day. Liz Cheney, as you said in your intro, has changed the meaning of the name Cheney in American consciousness, thanks to voting for President Trump's impeachment and even more powerfully her co-chairing of the January 6th committee and her clear sense that the former president represents a threat to the republic. But it is Liz Cheney herself who is under threat in a primary in her native Wyoming, a state that not only voted in her dad and voted in her, but then voted 70% for Donald Trump. She's being challenged by a woman named Harriet Hegman, who's a Trump loyalist, who has the endorsement of the former president. And what's interesting in this, well, two things are interesting. First of all is the emergence of Liz Cheney herself as this figure of some kind of national integrity in the face of Trump. She's someone who voted 93% with Trump during his presidency. She's someone who defended waterboarding and the right of the administration to torture people in the early years that she was in Congress. So it's been a little bit surprising to watch her evolve into this champion on this issue, at least, of Democratic small d values.
Bruce, was there a eureka moment for her?
A couple of things happened. One is that after voting for President Trump's impeachment, she was evicted from the House leadership. She had a stellar rise. She's only been in Congress for 6 years. She was a deputy minority leader. And then Kevin McCarthy promptly defenestrated her after Trump's impeachment. And that, I think, sparked it in part. Partly, I think there's a sense that she represents the traditional conservative wing of the Republican Party, the Reagan Republicans, if you will, the Bush Republicans, the Cheney Republicans, and they all have watched the ground corrode beneath them. It's disappeared to the point that now the only way Liz Cheney can even think about holding on to her seat in the primary today is if hordes, and there aren't many hordes in Wyoming, and if hordes of Democrats change their party affiliation, which you're allowed to do in Wyoming right at the polling place, if they can change their party affiliation and vote in the primary for Liz Cheney, there is a slim, slim chance she could hold on to her seat in an overwhelmingly Republican state.
Well, I'm willing to change my party allegiance and vote for her.
Well, she is most likely going to lose. And then the question becomes, well, what's next for her? Is she planning to run for president in 2024 as a spoiler for Donald Trump, for example? Is she going to, make sure this becomes a national crusade? It's kind of an interesting moment, but it also relates in a profound way to what's been going on in primaries around the country, where while there have been a few cases, particularly in Georgia, where Trump critics and those who pushed back against election denial have held on to statewide office primary nominations. Overwhelmingly, I have to say, the former president's hold on the Republican Party is becoming ever more clear. Even here, you know, I'm speaking from Connecticut, a moderate state in the moderate Northeast. And here, there's a woman named Leora Silver, who is a Trump-backed, quite rhetorically in line with Trump, Republican nominee for U.S. Senate against Dick Blumenthal, who captured the nomination in her party's primary last week against a quite established political figure from actually the Trump-voting middle of Connecticut, who had the nomination of the statewide party, but who was a critic of the former president. Even here in Connecticut, Trump rules. Now, this is a primary, right? As all of these elections right now are, turnout is low. But Leora Silver, Trump Republican, won not only in the Trump voting parts of the state, but in the parts of the state that did not go for Trump in the presidential election. This doesn't mean Connecticut is becoming Trumpier, but it does mean that the Connecticut Republican Party is the motivated voters are the Trump voters. And this is what we're seeing in primary after primary, where in Arizona, the election officials who had tried to defend the state's election, Republican election officials, lost their office. We're seeing it play out over and over around the country, and that's what's going on the ballot in the fall.
Now, this is a pop cultural reference which will be lost on almost my entire audience, but what's the impact of Ephraim Zimbalist Jr.'s raid on Mar-a-Lago?
Oh, we are showing our age, Philip, aren't we? The FBI in living color. You know, this is actually fracturing Republicans. At first, we saw this wild circling of the wagons around former President Trump. But when the warrant was unsealed and it became clear that what the FBI had taken were some of the most highly guarded classified documents in the whole pantheon of classification. And in fact, that there's a serious criminal inquiry under the Espionage Act, and that FBI agents were under threat. The guy tried to break into the FBI office in Cincinnati and then led police on a wild chase before being shot. All of this is going on. You now have some Republicans saying, wait, aren't we the party that defends law and order? Shouldn't we, like, be standing up for the cops? And you're beginning to see a big split between those Republicans closest to Trump, people like Lauren Boebert and others, who are calling the FBI the Gestapo and are ginning up a lot of violent rhetoric, and others who are saying, wait, let's wait and see here. It's, again, evidence of the split in the Republican Party, but also kind of interesting to see President Trump hoist on the petard of the Espionage Act, which, of course, he himself, his administration, used to indict Julian Assange back in 2019.
Now, before I let you go back to bed or whatever's going on over there, as you know, I'm replaying a chat with Salman Rushdie from 1995 on, yes, freedom of speech. I think he would like to say something about this.
Well, first of all, obviously, it's a horrific, horrific violent attack. But even more violent or historically resonant in a way because of the location. Rushdie was stabbed at a place called the Chautauqua Institute in far western New York. This, on the one hand, it looks like a sort of a summer ideas festival, and it is, but it's actually the birthplace of a profoundly important intellectual movement that swept the country. Back in the 1870s, Chautauqua became the seat of a novel attempt to bring college-level, university-level public discussion to rural America. It actually became a kind of certificate-granting institution, sponsored seminars, and that in turn spawned mini Chautauquas, became lowercase, all through rural America, where you had circuit riding TED Talks, really the ancestor of that, which up until the 1920s was a profoundly influential way of bringing secular debate over culture and ideas to parts of America that had been cut off from the currents of urban cosmopolitan culture. It was of profound importance. And so to have this attack on Mr. Rushdie happen at the birthplace of this intellectual movement, the Chautauqua movement, means something very particular in American history. It's a sad moment.
Bruce, thank you. Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor with The Nation and exec director of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music, and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.